All right, so this is Bio 241, and this is our first meeting. This is January 12th, and this is the Monday-Wednesday class. So when you record something, you change the nature of the class a little bit. Like, we won't get so rowdy in here, so don't say anything you don't want the whole world to hear, right, because it's going to go up on the internet. And then, of course, I shouldn't say things that I don't want the whole world to hear either. So it kind of dulls the conversation a little bit, but I think the trade-off is really good because you have a record of everything that you're responsible for in class. Okay, but I do realize that confidentiality is very important for some students, and if you wish for me not to record the lecture, all right, because someone might hear your voice if you were to ask a question during a lecture, then you have to let me know in writing, and I won't record the lectures and put them online. Okay. So hopefully everybody will agree to do that, but confidentiality is very important. If you wish to record lectures yourself, then you have to get permission from me to do that. All right, so make sure you just get permission from me. And also, and you've been through an anatomy class, there are different ways to record live sessions. You can record audio, or you can record it with still pictures, digital pictures, or video. And for video and pictures, absolutely no video or pictures are allowed in lab or in lecture of anybody, right? Because this is not just walking out on the street. This is not a public setting. This is more of a private setting. So you can't just take pictures of people, including the instructor, during a lecture or during a lab or anything. Okay. Now, if you want to take pictures or videos of whatever you're doing in lab, that's fine. But just don't ever photograph anybody that's in lab, right? Because some people need their confidentiality maintained. Okay, so one of the helpful places that you're going to go to is what we call Blackboard. That's your virtual classroom. And here is the web address. All right, it's just cypresscollege.blackboard.com. And no www in front of it. You have to type in your username, and your username is your Cypress College ID number, preceded by that funny little symbol, the at symbol, and then your ID number. All right, so that's mine. And then the password, you also need a password, and that should be the same password that you have for WebStar. All right, so what's my password? Dot, 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 dot. Okay, but that's not going to work for you. All right, so then when you get into Blackboard, so if you're officially registered in the class, you're going to see on the right-hand side over here a bunch of classes that you're registered for, but you probably aren't going to be registered for as many classes as I am. So this is going to be really easy for you to find your particular class. So this looks like a valid class right here. Okay, and you can see that there's going to be a menu opening up on the left-hand side where we have course information, course documents, and on the right-hand side, as soon as you log in, there's going to be an announcements page. So all the announcements that I pass out during the course of the class, you can read over here. And there might be some links involved. All right, so what I want to go to is course information, and since I don't have a syllabus to pass out to you, let's look at the syllabus on here. So here is an active link for syllabus. You can see that's a Microsoft Word document. And you can open it up in this frame right here of Blackboard, or better yet, you might want to download this file to your computer so that you don't have to be online every time you want to take a look at it. And the way that you do that is most computers on their mouse, they have two buttons. Right, there's the left-hand button that you usually click to execute a link, but there's a button on the right-hand side that hardly anybody uses. We call that the right-hand mouse button. So click that one. All right. Once you get over the link, click the right-hand mouse button, and you're going to have a window, and what you want to do is save target as. So you're going to save this as a file on your computer. So click this. It's going to download that file, and I'll say save it on my computer. And hopefully it's going to ask me where I want to save it. I want to save it somewhere where it says 241 Spring 2009. I don't see it. Oh, that's because I haven't worked on this computer yet. Okay. Spring. You see it up there? That's 2008. That's close. Oh, here it is. Oh, okay, forget it then. Yeah, here it is. Okay, we'll just leave that as a new folder, so I'll click that, open that up. All right, and you'll see it's downloaded already. We'll go back and open that. Okay, let's go take a look and look at the syllabus. Okay. Oh, here it is over here. All right, so indeed, we're going to see this is Bio 241. Here are the section numbers for Monday, Wednesday section. And I guess I have to change that. All right, so this is me. And here's my email address and my telephone number. Here is the URL to where you might find lectures online, the audio recordings. And that's about the only thing that I'm going to have on this website for you. Okay, most everything else is going to be in Blackboard. Here's my office. You can come see me during office hours. And my room number is like the number of days in a year, except it's on the second floor of the building, not the third floor. All right, so that's pretty easy to remember. Here is your textbook. All right, so this is the 11th edition. I know some students want to use previous editions. I don't know how well that's going to work because I give you assignments and exam materials taken out of this textbook right here. Like, for instance, I'll give you a set of exam figures, and I'll give you the figure numbers from the 11th edition, and they probably changed their number from the 10th edition and certainly from the 9th edition. All right, so the 11th edition is recommended. If you want to hold on to an older edition, I'm going to put copies of the 11th edition in the reserve section of the library so you can just double check for yourself how the figures numbers correspond from one edition to the next. Okay. Then you also need this book for the lab. Definitely get an email account because I send out email notifications all the time. I think I only had two or three bounce back to me, which is pretty good. And then here are, this is the website for Blackboard. Okay, and we'll be doing some calculations in here, so a non-graphing, just basic scientific calculator will be helpful for you. All right, prerequisite for this class is Bio 231 or 210. 210 is an A&P class. Okay, so make sure that you have these classes under your belt. 230 is a course that's very similar to 231. That's an anatomy class. And high school chemistry or college chemistry is definitely recommended. Every student that takes a chemistry class before this one has always told me 100% that it was very helpful and that it improved your grade. And probably students in here want to get the best grade possible that they can. So chemistry is something that you should have. I think in here I also state that if for some reason it comes to anybody's attention that you don't have the prerequisite for this class, all right, then I reserve the right to drop you from the class. So we're really serious about it. So if you got authorization from a counselor, for instance, and you signed up for this class without the prerequisites, right, then I still have the ability to drop you sometime during the semester. So that's going to be, we're going to enforce that pretty brutally. Right, so make sure you have the prerequisites for this class. Email etiquette. When you send me an email, make sure in the subject heading, right, this is not in the body of the email, but at the subject field that anybody can see before opening up the email, you give me your name, you give me the course number, as well as the CRN number. So whenever I send you an email, you're going to get the course number and the CRN number so you know who it's coming from. And that's probably because I have, like 500 students and four or five different kinds of classes, online classes, on-campus classes. And I really won't have a clue as to what you're talking about unless I know who you are and what class you're in. So in the subject line, make sure you put all that information in there for me. Okay, and I might have a spam filter too that I won't even get your email if you don't put that information in there. So try to include all that. I've got a big section here on attendance, and basically just says you got to go to lab the whole period, and you got to come to lecture the whole period. I'm going to send around sign-in sheets, and if you don't come to class, then I gotta drop you. So this in lecture and lab, please sign the sign-in sheet, and then that's your receipt that you're in class. So if I drop somebody and you come to me and say, why did you drop me? I say, well, you weren't in class. And then you say, well, show me where I wasn't in class. And I go and I look at your name and you've signed in every time. Well, then, you know, I have to reinstate you somehow. Right? So this is your receipt that you're in class. So go ahead, sign it, and pass it around. And when you're done in the back, just pass it back down to the front. Last day to drop without a grade is the 25th of April. And all these links, of course, are active once you get this file. So let's move on to grading. Your grade is going to be based on quizzes and lab and lecture tests. That's pretty much the whole thing right there. And you're going to have either one or two quizzes per week in lab. Usually the one at the beginning of lab is going to be a little bit harder. It's going to cover the material that you worked with the previous week. And then at the end of lab, hopefully there's going to be a nice easy quiz just to recapitulate to help you synthesize and organize in your mind what some of the important points of that lab were. So I know somebody had a lab today. Did anybody have a quiz today already in lab? Yeah? Oh, that was nice. Like on the feedback loop or something, I hope. That was really a nice thing. So that helps you focus on what the important points of that particular lab is. It's not meant to be punitive or hard or anything like that. It's just meant to give you some feedback as to how you're doing in the class and focus your studying. All right, so you might have as many as 16 to 30 different quizzes. And the way it works is that you're going to get a maximum of 160 points for all your work in lab. So if you get 100% on all the quizzes in lab, how many points do you get? You get 160. And if you get 50% average in lab, then you get 80 points for lab. Okay, lecture tests. Each lecture test is going to be worth 100 points. There's going to be 5 of them. And the reason why we work it out like that is because if you have 5 100-point tests, that's going to count about 75% of your grade, and the lab quizzes will count for about 25%, which is how the class is organized, right? 3 hours for lecture, 1 hour for lab. So it's 25% versus 70%. So if we add up 160 and 500, that should be what? 660 points right here. That's the maximum, and then it's just a straight 90, 80, 70, 60 scale on down the line. Okay, academic honesty is very important. Don't look around during the test. Everybody has to be ethical and trustworthy. We don't want people, for instance, falsifying insurance or medical records. That is really bad. I mean, people can get killed and hurt that way, right? So don't look around during the test. All these other things, you can read by yourself. A lot of students ask for recommendations when they go into a nursing program or other kind of professional program, and I'm really happy to do that. I just make sure you give me your name, your ID number, and if it's been a while, give me a JPEG, because I'll probably recognize you if I can hear your voice, like if you call me over the phone, but if you just send me an email, I might not be able to picture who you are. So send me a JPEG, and then I'll be able to picture who you are. The course number, the CRN number, is real important because I'll want to look up your records in the class, and I'll have no clue where to find you unless I have your CRN number. Then give me your lecture and lab number, of course, the year and semester. And all importantly, you got to tell me when the deadline you need that letter by. Okay, and I should put in here the professional lead time is usually 2 weeks. Right? As a matter of fact, you should probably just know that. If you ever ask for a recommendation from anybody, make sure you give them at least 2 weeks to get it done. Right? If you just give them a day or two, they'll get it done, but I'm not sure it's going to be really helpful for you. Right? It's going to be done in just a couple minutes. So that's not really good for you either. Okay. All right, so here's the schedule. Today we're going to talk about this introductory material and homeostasis. That's chapter one. Not everything in chapter one we're going to cover today. If you've looked at it, you can see that more than half the chapter is just basic anatomy, namely histology. That stuff you should already know. Okay, and our first test is going to be on February 9th. And it's going to cover these chapters. For tests, you'll need a Scantron and eraser and a pencil. And the eraser's got to be really good. All right, so I think you can figure out how to read this schedule right here. And then here is the laboratory schedule as well. So that's pretty much the syllabus. I don't know if I've forgotten any real important thing to cover with the syllabus. Okay. Monday, Wednesday. And yours is Monday, Wednesday?
Yeah.
Not Tuesday, Thursday. Oh. Oh, okay. I don't know. We'll have to just double check and see what section you're in, if you're in a Tuesday, Thursday, or a Monday, Wednesday class. Okay. We'll just double check all that kind of stuff. Okay. I know, it can be really confusing with all of these dates. All right, the schedule is not really optimal. I don't like the schedule so much. I'd prefer to have the test on February 2nd, but you can see these little asterisks right here. I don't know if I should be telling you this or not. No one told me otherwise. But during this week, it's possible that we're going to have a disaster drill, right? And no one knows when the disaster drill is going to be. So it's supposed to simulate a real disaster. And I just don't want to have a test and have to have everybody walk out in the middle of a test, right? So I pushed the test back. It makes it a little awkward for us, but we'll push off this test. We'll just see. We just have a few lectures between the first and second test. But it's better than turning in your test after taking it for only a half hour when you're supposed to have it for an hour and a half. Right? I wouldn't want to do that for anybody. Okay. Okay, so that's the syllabus. Any questions regarding the syllabus so far? No? Okay. I guess I haven't downloaded it. All right, so let's go to Blackboard and let's look at this. All right, so how do you download this to your computer? The weekly study plan.
Right-click.
Save target as. And might want to just start a folder, 241, spring. Oh, then I got to open it. Or did I say open? Ah, here it is. Okay, so this is your weekly study plan that you should share with your lab instructor and with me, all right, maybe before or after class. All right, so an average student needs to spend about 3 hours of studying outside of class for every hour that you spend in class. All right, so that means for this class, you need to spend 18 hours a week. Right, if you want to acquire this information at the expert level, and pretty much everybody does, because you want to be competitive in your field. Right, unless you have an extensive background in chemistry or some other biology classes, 18 hours is what we're recommending. Right, so I want to be upfront with everybody in the class. You can have fun during the tests, but you got to put your time in before you take the tests. If you put the time in, chances are you'll have fun when you take them. Okay, so I have two tables right here. The top one is a proposed weekly study plan, and then the bottom table is the actual one. And I've just kind of put in some numbers here, the number of hours that you can spend studying maybe on Sunday morning, for instance. Maybe you can get it 1.5 hours in. All right, so what I would like you to do with this first table this week, fill this table in so that you can see if you can eke out about 18 hours worth of study time. All right, plan ahead. And then, as the week progresses, fill in on the second table down here the actual hours that you're studying. And you may or may not wish to share this with me, I'm not sure, but I'm just offering, right, to analyze this and go over it with you to help you get the best grade as possible. All right, so I find this important because when people don't have a plan, they think they don't have a plan. All right, but that's not true. Because if you don't have a plan, what is that a plan for? That's a plan for failure, right? So you can say, oh, well, I'm just going to wing it. I don't need a plan. But if you don't have a plan, you really have a plan, and it's not a very good one. All right, so success in here is not an accident. A failure to plan is actually a plan to fail. So you need a plan. Start working with this and see if you can eke out the hours in your schedule so that you can get a good grade in this class. Okay, and this is online. You can print this out once a week. And, you know, I might want to go over this with you sometime. You know, if you're saying, oh, you know, I missed an A by 4 or 5 points. I really need an A in this class. Well, we're going to look at everything. We'll look at different sections of the test to see if you're missing one thing or another, and we can optimize your study techniques. So I think this is very helpful. And you should probably work with this with your lab instructor as well. Okay. All right, let's go back to Blackboard one more time. Course documents. Lecture PowerPoint slides. Here is what we're going to cover today. So I want to download this to the computer. Right click, save target as. 2009. I think that looks okay. Now come on and back and say, do you want to open? It's not asking me if I want to open. Okay, well, that's okay. We got it right here. All right, so here are the PowerPoint slides that you can download. And I suppose I recommend that you print them out. Maybe 4 slides per page, something like that. I don't know if I would print them out in color. You certainly can if you're interested. Maybe you're at work and you have a nice color printer at work, right? But if you're at home, you're going to go broke printing out all these slides in color, right? So as a matter of fact, your employer might as well. So I just print them out in black and white. Okay, so in this class, this is not an online class. It's not a hybrid class, so you're not required to have a computer to complete this class. So if you can't download this material and print it out, let me know, and I'll get the material for you one way or another. I know some students will just download it to their laptop, and they won't even ever make a hard copy of it. Right? They'll just work within their laptop. You're welcome to do that. As long as your laptop isn't real noisy and disturbing people around you. If you're like you're a really loud typer, I've been in some meetings with some really loud typers, and that's all you hear is click, click, bam, 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 click, click. Okay, so that's you? Yeah, so, or if maybe you can just lighten up on the keyboard a little bit. Okay. All right, and if you need a tutorial on PowerPoint, how to print them out that way, let me know. If you don't have PowerPoint in your computer, you can get a free PowerPoint viewer on a Microsoft website. Maybe I'll put the link in here. But with the viewer program, I don't believe you can print multiple slides per page. You can only print one per page. So we can deal with that if the time comes. Okay. All right, so those are some of the important things that we were talking about so far. I don't remember anything else that I need to tell you at this point in time. I'll show you some more materials that I have online for you as we go along. If I tell you everything that's online today, we won't have time for anything else. Yeah. Extra credit? Usually no. Sometimes yes, but recently no. And probably you won't get any extra credit in lab either. So sometimes I find that extra credit takes time away from what you should be studying. Okay, and I think if you just study the things that I say in class, that would be really good without giving you additional stuff to work on. Okay, so there's usually no extra credit in class. Yeah?
Will there be a study guide?
Yes, I have study guides, and they're on Blackboard. Let me just go back to Blackboard real quick and see what I have there. Okay, so course documents, assignments. Now, here are all the things that I have to look at yet and make relevant to this semester. I have some homework. I've got exam study guides, But in the next couple of days, I'll activate all these links for you. Okay? Okay. So this is kind of interesting. Well, I'll maybe just tell you just a little bit about that. The study guides. When it comes time to take a test, all right, the tests are going to have different components to it. There'll be multiple choice. They might be fill in the blank. And usually no essay, but that's a possibility that there might be an essay question. Usually I like to have essays in laboratory, not lecture so much. And then a lot of times students are what we call visual learners, okay, not auditory or reading learners. So there's also a graphical component to every test. So I give you a list of exam figures. The figures are in your book. And I might photocopy a figure right out of your book, erase all the labels off of it, and then during the test, you have to relabel it. So it could be flow diagrams, or I suppose it could be anatomy, but we don't stress that in here. But it'll be physiologic concepts that you have to relabel that diagram, but it's more graphically based. Okay, so that's why it's important probably to make sure you know exactly what exam figures I'm talking about, right, from the 11th edition. Okay, but I also include those figures in the study guide. So you can download those figures, the labels are erased, and you can practice labeling those figures, you know, 10 or 20 times before you take the test. Right? So that's in the study guide as well. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. The study guides are the key to what are going to be on the exam, and those usually follow my lectures. But there might be some easy kinds of questions that I tell you from questions at the end of the book or the online questions that maybe I didn't cover explicitly in lecture, but those could be on the test as well. Okay, so mostly lecture material, but just like the exam figure, all the exam figures I cover in class. But there might be a question at the end of the chapter that I don't specifically go over, but if it's listed on the exam study guide, then definitely you should go over it and quiz yourself. And you know what? If you have extra time in lab, you should probably form some study groups in lab and quiz each other on the web materials or labeling diagrams. So when it comes time to take the test, you're really familiar with that stuff, right? So I wouldn't leave lab early. Because if you have a question, you can always ask the lab instructor to help straighten it out for you. Yeah? You know, if it's later on in the semester, I'll check with students first. I'll give you an opportunity. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Okay. Hi.
Do you curve exams for
me? No, I kind of make the test up. I know ahead of time how things should go, so there's really no curving in there. So actually, everybody in here could get an A. I know some programs don't like that, but as far as I'm concerned, everybody in here could get an A, or everybody could get a B, depending on how you do on the exams. Okay. Yeah, because I give you enough study materials to where you should be pretty familiar with what the test is going to be like. Okay? Okay. All right. So let's see. We started at 3. We go to 4:20. Okay. Okay, study of body function. What do we call the scientific study of function? That is physiology. Exactly right. What's the scientific study of structure? That's anatomy. Yeah. And you're going to see that there is a relationship between structure and function all the time. A molecule will have a certain function because it has a certain kind of structure or certain kind of shape. Exactly right. So we're going to learn about a lot of structure-function relationships. You began to study them in anatomy a little bit. But we'll really carry on and emphasize function in this particular class. Okay, so a good example of that is, for instance, think of a dog or a cat and their paw, and compare that to a human. What can you tell me about the function of a human compared to a dog or a cat? Can a cat or a dog take notes?
No.
Do they have language skills with their paws? No. Now, why is that? We're talking about a function. Why can't dogs and cats have a written language? Because what's special about the structure? Okay. Yeah, some have 5 digits. I guess cats only have 4 digits on their forepaw. But humans have this thumb that is opposable, right? So we can pinch things. We can grab things, right? So we can take notes, right? We can grab things. We can manipulate. So the structure of our hand actually provides or makes that hand acquire different kinds of functions than other kinds of hands just because of the structure. So we're going to focus on function in here, but it's always going to be related to the structure of the molecule or the structure of an organelle, and we don't want to forget any of that kind of stuff. Okay. All right, but this is a physiology class. We're going to emphasize function. Okay, so human physiology. Physiology is just the study of how the body works to maintain life. And the basis for that is that there's got to be an underlying structure that provides for that kind of function. And when the structure changes, right, maybe chemicals change shape or some part of your body changes shape, guess what happens to the function of your body if your structure changes? The function is going to change as well, right? If the shape of a molecule changes, it might not have the same kind of function. And if it produces disease, then we call that pathophysiology, right? If that functioning now produces a disease state, takes you away from what your normal environment should be on the inside of your body, we call that pathophysiology. We don't emphasize pathophysiology very much in this class. We emphasize normal physiology a lot so we can understand the basic mechanisms first. All right, so pathophysiology is the study of physiological processes as they are altered by injury or disease. Okay, and so when we say scientific study, we use a scientific method to understand reality. And there are a number of steps involved with the scientific method. I want to go over these kind of quickly. All right, the first step is forming a testable hypothesis about some observations that you might see repeated in nature or about yourself time and time again. And you might say, oh, well, I kind of know what's happening here. And something is happening in me because of such and such a reason. And we call that a hypothesis. So a hypothesis is something that doesn't have any evidence to back it up. It's just a guess as to how the real world is operating. Okay? The second step, then, is to design experiments to test the hypothesis. And you conduct those experiments, you analyze the results, right? Basically to either support or disprove your hypothesis. Right? And then after you analyze the experimental results, you draw conclusions about whether or not the results support the hypothesis. Right, so remember, a hypothesis is just a guess. Okay, and then after many kinds of experiments that are done by one person, and then if they're repeated by other people, that hypothesis can turn into or evolve into a theory. Right, so in this, what I want you to really appreciate is the difference between a hypothesis and a theory. So if somebody comes up to you and says, I have a hypothesis how you can make $1 million overnight. And another person comes up to you and says, I have a theory of how you can earn $1 million overnight. Which person are you going to listen to? The person that has a hypothesis or a theory?
Theory.
A theory, right? Because a theory is based on proven fact, based on experimental evidence, right? All right, so a theory is a general statement explaining natural phenomena, and it's based on proven hypotheses. It's just not a random guess. Okay. Hypothesis is just an idea, and you could say even a guess. And these terms really are misused in our society. A lot of times people say, oh, I have a theory on how this is working. And we kind of get interested and we go, oh, yeah, that sort of makes sense. But is that a theory? That's really not a theory. Because no one has done experiments to prove it or disprove it, it's really a hypothesis. But we don't say hypothesis probably because it's such a big word, right? Okay. But from now on, maybe you should say hypothesis. It's probably a good thing to say. Okay, so how do you test a hypothesis? All right, this involves usually a couple of different groups. There's an experimental group and a control group. Okay, and the experimental group gets some kind of treatment, and the control group doesn't get that particular kind of treatment. We look at the results and compare the results from these two different groups. We perform quantitative measurements, and they're performed blindly. That means that who's ever giving some particular treatment to a patient, they don't know if that patient is in the experimental group or the control group. So it's important because anytime you say something, it's not necessarily what you say, but how you say it and how you look. So you could be distorting the results of this particular test just by the way that you're talking to somebody if you know what the expected results should be. Okay, and then we like to analyze data using statistics. Again, that's an unbiased way of analyzing data. Okay, so the big take-home message is something that you should be able to answer for yourself. What is the purpose of the scientific method? Why do we go through all this trouble of control groups and experimental groups and writing down a hypothesis and analyzing data with statistics? Yeah, to prove ideas, right? But to prove them in a very accurate way, right? Because what we would like is dependable information. And so the purpose of the scientific method is to give us dependable information, something that we can rely on. Okay, just so that we don't just throw out hypotheses because a hypothesis may or may not prove useful, right? Okay, and what's important, I think the reason why I talk about scientific method a little bit in this class is that in your textbook, everything that's in your textbook is a result of the scientific method. Right, all of these ideas that you're going to be reading about have evolved or come to be via scientific method. So everything that you're reading in your textbook is really a theory. It's not a hypothesis. So it's real important information. It's information that you can count on. Right, it's just not something that somebody believes to be true. All right, so for this question right here, just say reliable information. Gives us reliable information. Okay, so we might use scientific method to develop new drugs. When a new drug is suggested by experiments, its effectiveness and toxicity is first tested in just living cells, tissue culture, because we don't want to hurt animals. And then if it passes tests for tissue culture, then we move on to animal models like rats or mice, right? And I think that's very important. I know a lot of people don't like to use animals for experimentation, but it saves a lot of human lives and misery when we do that. Right, so that's an important step. Okay, before we start to test drugs on people. Okay, let me go back to this right here, the difference between an experimental and a control group. So for instance, we might be interested in testing the use of a hormone, maybe something like estrogen, for somebody. And estrogen is a lipid. And what can you tell me about a lipid or a fat? Okay, is there anything special about a lipid and a fat? Okay, like for instance, butter is a lipid, or it's a fat substance. And if you get some on your clothes, can you just take a wet paper towel and clean that butter up off your clothes? What can you tell me about butter and water? They won't mix. And we're going to learn a lot about these properties, some physical chemistry of different molecules, because lipid is hydrophobic. It doesn't dissolve in water. So when we give somebody estrogen and give them a shot of estrogen, right, the shot can't have any water in it because estrogen won't dissolve in that material. It's not a good vehicle for estrogen. So what do we have to use to dissolve estrogen in before we can inject somebody with it? It has to be an oil. Okay, so estrogen has to be dissolved in oil. You give somebody a shot of estrogen, they get estrogen, but what else do they get? They get the oil, right? And you know what? Oil has properties of estrogen. And so when you give somebody a shot of estrogen and oil, you don't really know if the effects that you're measuring are due to the estrogen or the oil, because they have similar effects. So how will you control for the effects of that shot of oil that you're giving as well as the estrogen? Yeah, you have two groups. One group gets the oil plus estrogen, and the other group is what we call the control that just gets the oil, and then you compare those two groups. So the experimental group and the control. So the control group gets everything that the experimental group gets except what? That one active ingredient. And then you have a really good idea of what the effect of that estrogen is on somebody. Okay, so that's the importance of using control groups. Okay, and where do you start? You start with tissue culture, rats, mice, maybe dogs or something like that. And again, experimental group as well as the control group. All right, and then once it passes your animal model test, then that drug is tested in a human population. And the Federal Drug Administration has set up a number of different kinds of trials to test for the safety and the effectiveness of these particular drugs. All right, so phase one trials. Toxicity and metabolism is tested in normal, healthy volunteers to see if it has any deleterious effects. That's a very important first step. Right, because you're going to see anytime somebody is sick, right, that's a very, very difficult situation to understand and appreciate. You're going to see in lab where we can take ECGs, we can measure pulse very easily from people. Okay, but what happens if somebody has diabetes and they have peripheral vascular disease? You might find, well, it's almost impossible to take the pulse of somebody, because there's so much disease in their blood vessels, you can't even take a pulse by monitoring their radial artery right here. Okay, so anytime you go to a disease population, everything changes. You can't use the same methods as a healthy population. So we start with a healthy population. Okay, then the drug is tested for the toxicity and effectiveness in a very small test population, right? And if it doesn't harm anybody and it produces positive effects, then we then increase the sample size. We test that drug on more and more people. All right, and then the last phase, the phase four trials, the drug is tested for other potential uses. So the drug, as it's administered through this process right here, notes are kept on every particular patient. Right, and kept. They're never, ever thrown away. And even after FDA approval, drugs are continually monitored to catch side effects. Some side effects might be adverse, might hurt a patient, but there might be side effects that are beneficial and beneficial to other kinds of patients. So I think this is important to mention, because FDA approval, as opposed to other kinds of drugs that somebody might take that are not FDA approved, right, you don't have that same dependable information that you can rely on. Like, for instance, food supplements, vitamins, and other kinds of food supplements. You don't really know what those effects are. Okay, but any kind of FDA-approved drug, you pretty much know that it's been tested through this long process and that records are kept, you know, forever on that particular drug. So that if something is ever discovered later on, we can find those patients again and hopefully help them, as opposed to food supplements. Right? If all of a sudden we learn that ginkgo biloba causes some kind of cancer, are we ever going to know about that? You know, ginkgo biloba is not an FDA-approved drug, right? So that information is not going to be disseminated, as opposed to an FDA-approved drug. Okay. Well, let's talk about homeostasis. Homeostasis is a kind of a complicated term to understand. Homeostasis just means staying the same. Okay, but it's a condition in which various internal parameters inside your body, like blood pressure, your pH. Does anybody know what pH is? What's a pH a measure? It's a measure of something. It's a measure of acidity inside your body. And the acidity is as a result of a hydrogen ion. We're going to see where this hydrogen ion comes from pretty soon. Okay, but it's a measure of the acidity or the alkalinity inside your body. And it can't change very much, right? Your blood pressure shouldn't change very much either, right? Your temperature, what about your temperature? Is your temperature changing very much? That one you should be familiar with a lot already, right? Your temperature is what, 98.7, something like that? Might change a little bit, but not a degree or two unless you start exercising very heavily. Your body temperature is maintained within a very narrow range in order to support life. That's what we call homeostasis, or one aspect of homeostasis. But fluid content, salt content in your body are all maintained within a range to support life. And we call that homeostasis. All right? But in a lot of parameters, we see that it is a dynamic state where all the body's systems are working and constantly adjusting to the changing internal environment and external conditions. So you need to have, for instance, a certain kind of water concentration in your body. But what are you doing all day long? You're drinking. So what happens to your water concentration? Is it absolutely constant? But when you drink something, okay, your water concentration increases. Right? And as a matter of fact, you can overdose on too much water. That can be lethal, right? But what does your body do to compensate for your consumption of water? You start to excrete it, right, through urination. So your water concentration can go up, it can go down, but it only stays within a narrow range, okay? And the other thing is, too, you don't urinate all the time. Right? So your urination is not constant. It is dependent on the amount of salt that you eat, the amount of water that you take in. So the amount of excretory fluid that your kidney produces changes. Right? So that process is changing all the time. Right? So homeostasis doesn't mean that your temperature doesn't change at all, that your salt concentration doesn't change at all. It means that it changes. Other things in your body have to change to bring these parameters back into a normal range. Okay. So the way that I like to envision homeostasis is that it's really a dance. It's a dance of all these parameters: your temperature, water concentration, salt concentration, blood pressure, glucose concentration in the blood. All of these things are moving up and down with respect to each other, but they're all moving how? So that none of them go way out of bounds. They're all changing a little bit so that they all stay within a normal range to sustain your life. And I kind of think of that in terms of a Star Trek episode from way back when. Right, one of the early Star Trek episodes. Who is the doctor on Starship Enterprise? Yeah, Bones. I guess was that McCoy, Dr. McCoy? And when somebody would get sick, they'd take them to the infirmary, put them on a table, and at the head of a table, there was this monitor. Okay? And what was that monitor doing? It had some arrows. They had like five or six columns and some arrows. And what were these arrows doing? They were all moving up and down. Right? So the arrows are doing, they're measuring pH, blood pressure, respiratory rate, temperature, and these arrows are bouncing up and down. Okay, and if they're bouncing up and down within a nice narrow range, that patient was pretty stable. Well, what would happen if all of a sudden now all the arrows went down and became stationary? Well, then the patient has died, right? And then what would Bones always have to say? He's dead, Jim. That was his favorite line, right, in the whole series. So if everything is stable, that really doesn't necessarily mean a living state. That could be a dead state, stable. A living state is what? When things are bouncing around, compensating for changes in other parameters inside your body. So think of homeostasis as more of a dance rather than just a constancy. So that's why they come up with this term, which I really don't understand, is what? Dynamic constancy. Dynamic constant means what? Just a small change around each other. Okay? So it's constant but small changes. All right, so dynamic state I like, but this dynamic constancy I don't like so much. All right, so the way that your body maintains homeostasis is by regulation. And in order to regulate various systems in your body, right, there have got to be what we call reflexes. There are long-range reflexes and short-range reflexes. Okay, here are a couple of long-range reflexes. Where a cell, okay, a hormone-secreting cell, secretes a hormone outside of itself, and that hormone diffuses and is picked up by the circulatory system. And once it's in the circulatory system, where does it go? Everywhere in the body, because your circulatory system goes everywhere in the body. So this is long range. All right? So what do we call a gland that secretes a hormone? I don't know why anybody would know that, because we haven't taken the class yet, but that's what we call an endocrine gland. So an endocrine gland is a gland that secretes a product, right? And that product, in this case, is a hormone. That product gets picked up by the circulatory system and is distributed through the whole body, right? As opposed to one that just travels through the interstitial fluid to other tissues in the body. All right, so this is a typical endocrine kind of control system, and it's long range because this hormone goes everywhere in the body. All right, a nerve cell right here, you can probably recognize that as a nerve cell because of all the processes here. What do we call this process on a nerve cell? That's a dendrite, and this right here is an axon, right? So this is a cell that secretes a product outside of itself as well, but it doesn't go into the circulatory system. It just goes into the interstitial space, and it's going to bind to a neighboring cell, another neuron, or some kind of effector cell. This is what we call a neurotransmitter. A neurotransmitter is secreted by a nerve cell. All right, and it's going to change the function of this cell right here. Then there are times when we have, what kind of cell is this again? You've got dendrites and axons, that's a nerve cell. But there are circumstances when this nerve cell is told to release a chemical, right? And that chemical doesn't just diffuse to a neighboring cell, it gets picked up by the circulatory system. What do we call something that gets picked up by a signaling molecule that gets picked up by the circulatory system, goes everywhere in the body? That's what we call a hormone. But what did we call a substance that secreted, a signaling molecule that's secreted by a nerve cell? We call that a neurotransmitter. All right, so what do we call this thing? Is it a hormone or is it a neurotransmitter? Because it has components of each, right? So in this particular case, we're going to call this a neurohormone, right? Because it has components of being a hormone as well as a neurotransmitter. Okay, and then that neurohormone will travel to its target tissue where it's going to elicit some kind of response in that target tissue. And so these are long-range reflexes because these signaling molecules, either hormones or neurohormones, are carried through your body via the circulatory system. Okay, other kinds of signaling molecules are short-range, right, and we call this local control. When a cell releases some kind of agent, we're going to call this a paracrine agent, and it does not enter the circulatory system. It just has an effect in the neighborhood of the cell that secretes it. All right, so we call that a paracrine agent. Sometimes a signaling molecule is secreted by a cell, and it doesn't go anywhere. It just goes back to the cell that secretes it and changes the metabolism inside the cell that secreted it. We call that an autocrine agent. So paracrine will affect neighboring cells, an autocrine agent will affect and change the metabolism of the cell that has actually secreted it to begin with. Okay, so I kind of would like for you to know the definitions of an autocrine versus paracrine agent, okay, and also have an appreciation for local control versus long-range control, okay, or reflex. Okay. All right, so continuing on with homeostasis. Homeostasis is the maintenance of a state of what your book calls dynamic constancy. It's just kind of confusing term for me. It means what? Not everything is absolutely constant, but fluctuating in just little amounts. All right, in which the homeostasis is a condition which stabilizes, right? The the parameter can move up and down or above and below what we call a physiologic set point to maintain life. And it's going to be maintained by negative feedback loops. So we can see these dotted lines right here represent the conditions that are going to maintain life. So let's just say this is body temperature. We can see that there is a set point right here. This is what we call the normal body temperature, 98.7 or 98.8. Right? And you might not be able to measure that in you, but you're going to be close to that. So, for instance, when you start to exercise, guess what happens to your body temperature? It goes up. All right, so that means what? It's not constant. It's changing. All right, your body fluids, on the other hand, are going to respond. What's going to happen to water inside your body when your body temperature goes up? Well, its temperature is going to go up, but how do you cool yourself? You start to sweat. You lose water. So now you're losing water. That's driving you away from homeostasis with your water balance, but what's happening to your body temperature when you start to sweat? It cools down. So your body temperature is coming back down, right? So your body temperature comes back down. And as your body temperature comes back down, what happens to your sweating processes? Okay, it slows down or stops, right? Then you get a sensation that you're thirsty, so you drink some water, and now you bring your water balance back to where it should be. Okay, so your body temperature is maintained, your water balance is maintained, not absolutely constant, but slowly changing within what a normal range that is suitable to support life. Okay, so that's why a lot of people like to call that a dynamic constancy. The best way to appreciate homeostasis, a nice analytical approach, is to understand homeostasis in terms of feedback loops or response loops. And your book doesn't have a lot of good pictures of a response loop, but I give them to you from another textbook, and that's, I think, what they showed in lab, all right, or what you will show in lab, and you get a copy of those PowerPoints too. Okay, so let's look at this diagram that shows us a response loop. So X is just some kind of physiologic parameter. And we could think of, for instance, temperature. That could be temperature as well. All right, so X might be temperature. And we see this arrow that's pointing up. That's to signify that the body temperature is increasing. All right, and in order for your body to understand that your body temperature is increasing, what does it have to have? Right? And as a matter of fact, if somebody shines a flashlight on you, in order for you to know that flashlight is shining on you, what do you need to have? Okay, you need to have eyes. Yeah, you need to have a sensor for that particular modality of energy. Right? So in order for your body to understand your temperature is changing, what does it have to have? It's got to have a thermometer someplace in your body. We call those thermoreceptors. Okay, temperature receptors, so your body can actually measure temperature changes because there are cellular receptors that can measure temperature. Okay, so this right here represents a change in temperature. It's increasing. We call this a stimulus. So the first part of a response loop is a stimulus. The second part is, in order for your body to appreciate a stimulus, it has to have a It's got to have a sensor, and another name for a sensor is a receptor. Okay, you could say receptor or sensor. And then the sensor has to send that information to a processing center. That is usually in your central nervous system someplace. So there's got to be a pathway that takes the information from the sensor to your brain. What do we call a pathway that is a sensory pathway? I'll give you a hint. You told me already. That's good. Is it an afferent pathway or an efferent pathway? It's afferent. Afferent is entering into something, right? So the first step in a response loop is stimulus. The second is a receptor. The third is an afferent pathway. The afferent pathway takes it to the integration center. That's the fourth part of a response loop, integration center. And most of the integration, there are important integration centers in your spinal cord, and there's even more important integration centers in your medulla oblongata for blood pressure and temperature. Okay, so the integration center takes all of the information takes the stimulus information and it compares it to what it should be. What do we call that value of what all these parameters should be? And for temperature, it's what? It is 98.8. That's what we call the set point. So that's an important point that is contained. Where is the set point contained? Is it in the sensor or the afferent pathway? Where is it at? It's in the integration center. So set point is in the integration center. All right, so the integration center compares the value that it's getting from the sensor to what it should be. And if it's exactly the same, what does the integration center do? What does it have to do?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. Okay, so the integration center not only contains a set point, it has to make a decision on what to do based on what the error is from the set point compared to what's really happening inside your body. The integration center's got to make a decision. And if the body temperature is increasing right here, the error is your body temperature is too high, what's the decision that the integration center is going to do? You're going to say, well, we're going to divert blood from your core to your integument. You're going to start sweating, and you're going to release that heat into the environment, right? So blood vessels are going to dilate. You're going to start sweating. And then, so those are what we call effectors. Sweat glands are effectors. They're connected to the integration center by other nerves. So here is a pathway. What kind of pathway is this? Is this an afferent pathway? That is the efferent pathway. Takes signals to the effector, and the effectors are going to produce a response, number two over here, which is what we see, this decrease in body temperature. All right, so here is that full response loop. So you should know all the different components to it. So what does a response loop always start with? Stimulus. What does it always end with? A response. Right. Okay. And in this particular case, we saw the stimulus increased temperature, the response decreased temperature. So did the response add to the stimulus or subtract from the stimulus? Okay. Because if the response added to the stimulus, the temperature would increase. Okay, and then if there was a response that added to the body temperature, it would increase. So what's happening in that particular case? If the response adds to the stimulus, is your body temperature driven farther away from the set point or driven down to the set point? It takes it farther and farther and farther away. That means that you're losing homeostasis and you're going to be forced into a disease state and maybe even a lethal state when that happens, right? Hypothermia. Okay. When the response adds to the stimulus, we call that positive feedback. That sounds like a good thing, positive feedback, but what does it really do? It drives a parameter farther and farther away from set point. Right? If the response subtracts from the stimulus, we call that negative feedback. Right? So response subtracts from the stimulus, negative feedback. What does that do? That drives that parameter back to the set point that maintains homeostasis. So in most cases, negative feedback provides for homeostasis, a normal body condition. Right? So just because we say negative, it doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It really means what? It's a good thing. It's negative because response subtracts from the stimulus. Okay. So just to talk about one more point, what about X right here? Is it absolutely flat, constant? Is it doing what? It's changing. It's fluctuating. That's what really homeostasis means. Everything is fluctuating, but just in small increments. And small increments so that it never goes beyond some kind of normal range right here. All right, so here's a slide that you see in lab, okay, a nice response loop. And this you should be able to draw out and label properly. All right, so here are all the aspects of a feedback loop. Always starts with a stimulus. In order for you to appreciate a stimulus, you have to have a sensor or a receptor. That information gets passed on via an afferent pathway to an integration center. What does that integration center have to do? It's got to compare the incoming information with the set point, and then it's got to make a decision, right? And it could integrate a lot of different kinds of information together. Right? Maybe if your body temperature is increasing and you're exercising at the same time, maybe it's getting information about muscle tension. right? The integration center is going to say, oh, we really anticipate a big heat buildup. That's the integration center is going to make a different decision than compared if you're just sitting still and your body temperature goes up. Okay. The decision is sent out via the efferent pathway to the effector to produce a response, and the response will always have an effect on the stimulus because this is a loop. And if the response adds to the stimulus, that's what we call what kind of feedback? Okay. If the response, let me make sure I asked the question right, if the response adds to the stimulus, we call that positive feedback that drives the system farther away from the set point. But if the response subtracts from the stimulus, then that parameter, that's negative feedback, the parameter goes back to the set point, maintaining homeostasis and a healthy state. Yeah. I'm not sure I could analyze that in a response loop. I would say, you know, in that particular case, there is something that's controlling blood sugar, not a response loop, right? That's just the somebody outside that, for whatever reason, is misadministering insulin. So there's not a really good response loop. But what your body is going to do when that happens is that response loops will try to take over. Your body will stop secreting insulin and maybe secrete another hormone to boost your blood glucose back up. Glucagon will be secreted to boost your blood glucose back up. Okay, in that particular case, and I would say that negative feedback, how your body will compensate all by itself, okay, to bring your blood glucose back to where it should be. Generally speaking, maybe I have a couple examples right here where positive feedback is a normal, healthy circumstance, but in most cases it's not. It drives you farther and farther away from set point. Let me go through these slides. If I don't give you a normal circumstance of positive feedback in the slides, I'll be sure to tell you today. Okay. It's sort of academically interesting, a couple positive feedbacks. So response loop always begins with a, ends with a response. Okay. Types of feedback, you got negative and positive. Negative is a body mechanism by which any change from an ideal normal value is what? Made smaller or resisted. Right? As you drift away from set point, negative feedback drives it to the set point. It usually leads to a compensated, healthy state, maintains homeostasis. So the response subtracts from the stimulus. All right, just what we said. Positive feedback, on the other hand, is a body mechanism which any change from ideal normal value is made greater. So if your body temperature were to increase, positive feedback would make it increase even further, and then even further, and then even further. Until what happens? You burst into flames or something. I don't know what happens. Something bad, right? Something bad is going to happen. Okay. Positive feedback leads to a decompensated disease state away from homeostasis. Thus, a response adds to the stimulus moving away from set point. Okay. Let me just look real quick. Oh, yeah, I got a couple examples of positive feedback right here. Okay, let's talk about some other aspects of homeostasis. Your lab also goes into antagonistic versus tonic mechanisms. It's important that you know that, but I'm not going to cover that in lecture. But I will talk about intrinsic versus extrinsic mechanisms. Okay? So regulatory mechanisms can either be intrinsic or extrinsic. Intrinsic means that it pertains wholly within the organ that's being regulated. So intrinsic control is built into the organ. One real important organ is your heart. And the heart has to contract to pump blood to maintain blood pressure. And there is a lot of regulation that takes place just with inside the heart itself. It doesn't need hormones from this particular point of view. It doesn't need nerve supply. It can regulate itself. And we call this the Frank Starling law of the heart. As blood flows back to the heart, guess what happens to the heart as blood flows back into it? Does it shrink? Does it stay the same or does it expand? expands, it stretches as blood flows back to it. Oh, rats, I didn't bring my water bottle. Okay. So as the heart expands, it gets stronger, right? So that's real important, because as blood flows back to the heart has the ability to contract with more strength to pump that blood out to make blood maintain your blood pressure. So that's what we call an intrinsic regulatory mechanism. The heart does that all by itself. And that's very important clinically. We use that to treat patients all the time. What happens, for instance, if somebody has a hemorrhage and the blood is not flowing back to the heart? Where is the blood flowing? It's flowing out of your body. And it's flowing out of your body, it can't go back to the heart. And as the heart stops stretching, guess what happens to the heart? It gets weaker and weaker and weaker. So hemorrhage is a very dangerous condition because of this Frank Starling law. The heart gets weaker and weaker and weaker, so you got to prevent that bleeding. But it's, how do we treat a circumstance like that? How do we get the strength of the heart back so that you can maintain blood pressure? Stop the bleeding and give fluids. Give an IV. Get blood volume back up so that more fluid flows back to the heart. The heart stretches, it regains its force of contraction, right? And you can save somebody's life by doing that, okay? So that is intrinsic control. It just has to do with how proteins are arranged inside the heart. We'll look at that in this class. Okay, the next kind of control is what we call extrinsic. It's going to require other kinds of organs and maybe hormones or nerves to maintain regulation. Okay, so for instance, in terms of a variation in body temperature, we saw that there were sensors, and in order to maintain body temperature, you needed afferent pathways, efferent pathways, and effector organs like sweat glands. Okay, and if your body temperature goes too low, you need other kinds of effector organs like muscles to contract. All right, so in this particular circumstance right here, all right, we see that there is a variation, but this variation is within this normal range right here. What type of feedback is operating? Is this negative feedback or positive feedback? It's negative feedback, because when there is a deviation from normal, right, it's always forced back to the set point. So that's due to negative feedback, not positive feedback. If it was positive feedback, if body temperature were to decrease, what would happen? It would continue to decrease. Okay, and then you would die from hypothermia. All right, so extrinsic mechanisms require other kinds of organs inside your body to maintain homeostasis. Another example of extrinsic mechanism. Let's look at a plot of blood glucose concentration versus time. All right, so here's just a plot of blood glucose concentration versus time. And we can see it's pretty much normal right here. This is not a diabetic patient. This is just like, you know, most of us in here. But if we were to inject insulin at this point in time, insulin allows all the cells in the body to take glucose up, to import glucose from the blood to put it inside the cells. And as cells take up glucose, what happens to glucose concentration inside the blood? It's going to decrease because it's leaving the blood going inside of cells. All right, so this is an experimental condition. This is not necessarily how we want to treat somebody. This is just an experiment way to think. Okay, and as insulin is injected here, blood glucose concentration is going to decrease from, you know, like 98 all the way down below 50 milligrams per deciliter. That is due to this injection of insulin, okay? And we call this an extrinsic mechanism because there is an organ in the body that can measure blood glucose levels, and that is the pancreas. So the pancreas is not part of the blood. It's an organ all by itself. There are glucose receptors, and those glucose receptors are going to say, oh, blood glucose decreased drastically. What we need to do is stop secreting insulin. Right, so, and we need to secrete another hormone, glucagon, that is going to increase blood glucose levels right here. So what is controlling glucose levels in the blood is not the blood itself, it is really the pancreas along with a couple of other hormones. So that's why we call this extrinsic control. And there might even be some neuronal influences there as well, working through epinephrine. Yeah.
Are we gonna test questions on
these? Yeah, there could be some test questions on these.
Like
pancreas and things like that. Maybe not in the beginning chapter, but when we start talking about regulation of blood glucose and things like that, yeah. Yeah. So the things to focus on for the test are going to be explicitly in the study guide for you. Okay. Okay. Positive feedback, for instance, would be a result when blood glucose starts to drop. The pancreas says, oh, blood glucose is dropping. Let me secrete more insulin, which is going to drop blood glucose even more. And the pancreas says, oh, well, let me secrete some insulin to overcome that effect. Blood glucose is going to drop even more as a result of that. All right, so that would be positive feedback driving blood glucose away from the set point. But that's not really what happens during diabetes. All right, I just kind of made that scenario up. Okay, that would only happen when somebody gets an insulin injection at the wrong time. Okay, and so diabetics, of course, have to give themselves shots. Some diabetics give themselves insulin shots, but they have to do it at the right time. Okay, so a diabetic would never give themselves an insulin shot as soon as they wake up in the morning without having breakfast, because their blood sugar is going to drop. But a diabetic maybe would give themselves an insulin shot after they had breakfast. Okay, so that means that they're using their intelligence and their understanding of their disease to give themselves a proper level of insulin when the pancreas can't do that automatically. Okay. Oh, you know what? We're not done with today's lecture, but it's time to quit. So we're going to start here next time, but we're also going to move on to the next chapter. I can finish up these other couple of slides. Now, if you have trouble logging into Blackboard, you can see me now, or if you got other questions, that would be great. But I'm going to turn the microphone off right now.